Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? Derek Evers, Chris Robbins, Nothing Urgent.
With another Lego-tainted episode.
Don't hate on the Legos. They're like, you know, they help me with my constructive thinking.
Explain why anyone over the age of 7 should see that movie.
Oh, see the movie? I mean, the movie is like, you know, to be fair, if you're an adult, like, I don't think it's necessary to see the movie. I just went and saw it.
And you are an adult, correct?
Not at heart. I went and saw it just because, you know, I like Legos. And it was actually really... And I saw the other movies with nephews on DVD, and they were actually pretty witty and smart.
Wait, there's more than one Lego movie?
Well, that went straight to DVD. Like, they didn't have a theatrical release.
All right. What was the mean age of people in that movie theater when you saw the Lego movie?
Believe it or not, there was a lot of adults who were there without kids, but most of the people. Because there's it's kind of like, are you a fan of Adventure Time at all?
Yeah,
it's similar vein that like adults can enjoy the humor, but at the same time, you know, it's definitely meant for, you know, I wouldn't say little kids, but kind of, you know, middle level kids.
So you're a middle-level kid, is what you're saying.
Well, I say things like middle-level because I can't think of the appropriate word. So, you know,
Middle-school kids is what you... Yeah, really? Sort of. That old?
Right. Well, it's weird because the humor... It's like Adventure Time. You look at the humor and you're like, man, I'm glad my, like, you know, 6-year-old nephew can't understand this joke type of vibe. But at the same time, then there's this really simplistic, you know... ideas that are kind of like strewn throughout that you can understand.
Someone, there's a newsstand on Delancey Street that I pass by a lot, and there's a giant Lego movie poster on it. It's been there for a while, but it looks like someone smeared feces all over it in the past few days, and it made me smile. So there's that, you know. Man. You have your Lego movie, I have my Lego movie poster smeared with feces.
Yeah, you have your... Well, why don't you tell everyone about the movie you made me watch on Friday then?
You mean the film that we watched with Ray Liotta, among other, the Uwe Boll directed film?
Award-winning film? You mean award-winning director?
I'm sure that film won some awards.
What was the name? We don't have to talk about it. What was the name of it?
I honestly don't remember. Movies like that just flow in and then flow out, and then they're
gone.
It
was that good.
But we didn't pay to see it. That's what's important. And we didn't have to buy
it. I paid to
Legos
see it in 3D. Which really? I was kind of bummed about, because paying to see movies in 3D now is like...
Couldn't you just go play some with some Legos?
I did that afterwards. I went and bought Legos and built them afterwards.
Well, tell everyone about how wonderful the show is today.
I will say this
before you do that.
If you want to get... No, actually...
Let me finish my apologia on the Lego movie.
No,
first.
I was just going to say, if you want to seem like you're cool to any 6-year-old out there, just play with Legos and they'll like that. I realized before I said that, I was like, that could sound very, you know, Woody Allen creepy. But
free Tootsie Rolls, the back of Derek's van, all day, every day.
So joining us today, we have a very, I feel like I'm the dumb one in the room today, because we have a very smart...
We have a politically charged show today.
Politically charged, and it's full of authors here today, of which, you know, I am the least... What's the word I'm looking for?
You mean reporters, writers?
Yeah, journalists.
Okay.
I'm the least qualified, because I can't think of the words like qualified. We're joined by Tessa Stewart from The Village Voice.
Hello.
And who wrote an engaging cover story on basically pedestrians.
Why it's too easy to kill a pedestrian in New York.
See, there... we'll come back to that. But basically pedestrians and the rise of pedestrian death rates in New York City. And Marina... Galperina, am I saying that correct?
That's close enough, yep.
That's close enough. Who is a writer for Animal NYC, editor for Animal New York or Animal NYC?
Managing editor of Animal New York.
New York.
This is why I got to get this info beforehand.
Producer Joe, what's wrong with you?
Where's that slide whistle?
He's not here to defend himself.
I'm drinking a beer.
who's been covering the Pussy Riot since, I was going to say Pussy Riot scandal, or it's not a scandal, but basically they're, since the beginning of them being jailed throughout...
Since 2009.
Okay. See.
The year's better. Okay, but let's talk about... Can we... First, with Pussy Riot, because people... There were people on Twitter who were like, how is Pussy Riot as a band? Or, like, people treat Pussy Riot as a band. Like, is it a band or is it a movement? Or can you sort of loosely define what Pussy Riot means to Russians?
Well, Pussy Riot doesn't mean a lot to Russians, per se. It's a little more complicated there. But simple question, is it a band? No, it's not a band. There was a movement of performance art kind of burst with liberal philosophy that happened and crystallized around the time where Putin really went for the totalitarian bent and re-elected himself, re-estated himself president, and there were a lot of protests. And a bunch of art school kids and philosophy kids got together and started doing public stunts. And one of them was called Vaina, and they did the famous drawing of the dick and graffiti on the bridge. And Pussy Riot was part of that. There was a split. There was a St. Petersburg faction and a Moscow faction. Other people came in, and basically Nadia and Katya were part of Vaina, and then they focused solely on Pussy Riot, and they were supposed to be anonymous. But it's a performance. Like, if you know that the YouTube video is... Actually, they were only up there for 40 seconds up in the church. And the video was edited afterwards. It was meant to be a viral video. It's kind of a new type of performance disruption art.
It's propaganda, right? I mean, essentially.
Oh, God, I hear that word a lot with Russians.
But, like, in the best sense of the word.
Absolutely. It's kind of an inception of an idea. And a lot of people understood what it was. A lot of people, like Madonna, didn't, but still supported, because musicians, females in jail, that was obviously helpful for them in the long run. And Russians really mostly were watching the news, where the reports were, oh, these girls took a shit in the church, and other made-up kind of spin of that. So,
and you're
wait, did they really take a poop in the church?
No, they just danced around for 40 seconds. Oh. There wasn't even music playing.
I got excited there for a sec, because I thought it was like Gigi Allen on Geraldo.
No, but Nadia, when she was part of Vaina, they did a bunch of radical things. They did have an orgy in the lobby of a museum once. So,
but that was kind of the smartest thing that they could do, was to present themselves as musicians, right? Because that's how they first got really popular, was all these other musicians coming to their defense.
They were active before that, yeah. But the minute worldwide attention was pointed to them is when musicians came to, just as understanding, oh, these are punk rock girls in jail. They have no album, no songs, and they weren't supposed to ever tour or perform or charge money for concert tickets, which is why, well, I guess that's later, which is why the other members disowned them after the whole Amnesty International concert. Yeah. But it was not intended to be a band. They were actually, Miriam Elder, she's a foreign editor at BuzzFeed, wrote the definitive profile of them. Huge profile, but how it was funded is they were giving a lecture in 2009 or something, or earlier, a lecture in the opposition camp in Russia of all these thinkers and politicians trying to form some sort of actual opposition to Putin. And they started giving a lecture on feminism, and they listed popular feminist movements and bands, including Bikini Kill, and then they mentioned Pussy Riot as a band before it was even formed, but nobody knew any of them, so they just went along with it. But so once you say something as if it's true, it becomes true, and they just went off a more understandable mainstream concept, mm-hmm. too.
So, well, you brought it up, and I feel like today my role is to play devil's advocate across the board. So, I, you know, you brought up the disowning from the other members of the band, and we spoke a little bit about this via the social interwebs.
I believe we had a fight because you compared it to 285 Kent.
That's it, but see, that is... Well, what I'm getting at is, like, this idealist versus reality type of concept. And, you know, the other members of Pussy Riot, who disowned them, quote-unquote, were basically like, it's great that they're raising attention for this, but everyone's saying stuff and no one's actually hearing them. And there was a recent piece in Animal by the illustrator,
Molly Crabapple.
Molly Crabapple. Yeah.
Who kind of referenced the same thing. Like, basically, there's all these people, but, like, they, you know, when they write the story, they kind of whitewash over what their actual, you know, agenda is or what they're trying to say. And so I guess my question is, like, I'm fine with them accepting, like, this role on this large scale where they're playing, like, events that cost a lot of money to get into and stuff like that. But they're in New York City. What grassroots... Have they done anything grassroots? And, like, has there been anything that is not for, like, the uber successful to kind of be able to see them on any level?
Okay. Well, let's start with the word grassroots. The reason why their message gets drowned out, and it's just, this is something that they've addressed themselves on their Facebook and two journalists that actually wrote long form about them, is that the issue that they have dedicated themselves to is a very specific one, and it is prison reform in Russia. And it is so local and so boring and so not sexy that it just doesn't really get any pickup. Nobody wants to hear that. They want to hear about Ukraine or something else that's in the
And this has become their mission post
they were,
them
they were,
being
they
jailed,
were,
correct?
They were in jail for 2 years. They were convicted for hooliganism with the intent to incite religious hatred, which is a new law and ridiculous in every way. But they spent 2 years in gulags, essentially, in different ones, being hospitalized. Masha is vegan, so vegan is very foreign to Russians, especially
right.
prisons. And they've heard stories of people killing themselves, of being overworked, of not getting paid. At one point, they were making uniforms for policemen. And they experienced these horrors, and afterwards, the first thing they did after being released is they went and met with activists, and they formed a plan. And then this offer from Amnesty International came. It was like, oh, you want to do this? Well, Amnesty International has saved lives. You have to do this. It's kind of like selling your soul, but not really. But the main points that get lost from the letter, and I haven't translated on, I haven't seen the full translation of it, but the original, six other girls, anonymous, one of them is Katya, signed a letter, and they said that this dressing up and doing these concerts is against their radical feminist theory, which is true, and the logo for Amnesty International was a guy holding up a guitar and waving it over the bridge, but the strap got blown out, so you can't see the guitar strap, so it just looked like he's waving his dick at the bridge. It was little things like that really took
right,
me off, but
right.
they did what they could, and this is the role they're playing now, and it's understood that they've been separated from that quote-unquote brand, which everybody
right,
says,
right.
but this is, they knew this was coming, and I think they accept that, and when they went on stage at this, I mean, Amnesty International itself is not a concert, it's bands play three songs, bands
right,
like
right.
Imagine Dragons, which are not really bands, but horrible plagues from hell.
Right.
So,
well, I like that you mentioned that. Like, then they like whisked off stage, and then you know, Imagine Dragons comes on.
It's three songs at a time, and when like and Madonna, I don't think even performed, but when they were introduced, I don't know who expected them to sing, but people weren't really paying attention. She was Madonna was introducing them and said how bad it is in Russia in her own way, and someone behind me shouted, "Stay here," which is completely dumb because their whole point is activism. But they did the only thing they could, which was, ironically, they were wearing crosses on their shirts, which is not ironic, like ironic, but
right.
Symbolism in it. But what they did is they read verbatim statements given that day by a specific group of prisoners, which they were representing, which they actually accepted this deal from Amnesty for, which were arrested during May 6th, doing a protest against Putin for like throwing lemons, assaulting the police.
Right, right.
And these were the statements that were given literally hours early at Moscow, and they were repeating these words that they said of like how the system is crushing them. It was kind of a spoken word performance, really, but I don't know what else they could have done. It was...
Well, I guess, I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate because I see the you know, both sides of the coin, because they're reaching an audience that, A, you know, is much more massive than they would have otherwise.
And deeper pockets, too, more
well,
money.
Yeah, I get
to, like, put to whatever they want.
Well, this is another thing that the original members of Pussy Riot had a problem with, is you're charging $17 to $37 per
right.
ticket. We're not supposed to charge it. We're anti-capitalist, radicals, feminists, environmentalists. We're anti-capitalist, and you're charging money.
Also, how much of that money is actually going to their... It, and I assume it's going to prison reform, but this was a thing that I remember covering when they first kind of came onto the national scene, was there were these... I was working in L.A., and there were a bunch of benefit concerts, and no one knew where the money was going. They were like, we're going to send it to Russia, but they had no idea, like, what they were going to do with it. But do you know how much of the money from the Amnesty International concert?
I have no idea. Yeah. That's a really good thing for me to research, how many of them specifically went to defense of those specific people.
Right.
But it's more... At this point, it's more about keeping an issue in the headlines the right. most they can. I think they're very frustrated the fact they can't get the media to focus on those issues specifically.
Yeah.
But now it's all like, Pussy Riot is over. Even I'm guilty to that because I wrote kind of a tongue-in-cheek title to my article, The End of Pussy Riot as We Know It, and I was nuanced about it, but nobody reads anything at all, so...
Well, it's like, I guess, you know, if I was to use an example, maybe like Occupy Wall Street, in the sense that, you know, that got coverage on a lot of mainstream, on a mainstream level, but it wasn't really, you know, sending out the message that they wanted it to be sent out. So they would have a lot of like, you know, the Village Voices or the, like, you know, Gothamist type of places that were a, more of a mouthpiece. And I feel like they had to have known, and I'm asking you as someone who, you know, you weren't there, you weren't talking to them, but like they had to have known that, like, when they're going to fundraisers,
Barclays
that
Center.
Are, well, Barclays Center is one thing, but like a fundraisers, you know, where it's like, you know, upwards of $1,000 a plate, you know, things like that, that it, the message would be a little bit tainted to a certain extent.
They actually they knew that because Miriam, the foreign editor at BuzzFeed, she was with them in the car on the way over there, and they were. I think Masha was cynical and Nadia was kind of hopeful, like, why? We have this opportunity to do this.
Right.
I'm not sure they knew exactly how it was going to go. I think they're working on what they have at this
right.
point. Their masks are already off. It wasn't their choice to do that. They were supposed to be anonymous. And this is what they are now.
It's also we're, you know, in a bubble in New York, because I look at it from it. You know, if it was any other city, I'd be like, I do understand, so I'm not trying to downplay it, but I feel like if it was any other city, you'd be like, okay, you wouldn't be able to really reach many people otherwise. It's just like, I guess looking at it from a New York point of view, there's just so many, you know, like so many people that get heard that are like, you know, have much smaller platforms than that, what they had, that I would at least, again, I'm look idealist versus realist. It's like, I would have liked to have seen like the alternative, like, you know, approaching it from both angles. And I don't know what the other angle would be. Maybe it's, you know, I don't know.
I think
something in the park, you know, like a open for everyone at Central Park or something like that. But then again, that would take
well, there,
a whole bunch of other logistics.
That's why it's a YouTube video on the internet available for everybody. That was the original form of communication. But I think your comparison to Occupy is interesting to me because you said there's a dissonance in their message. They could not organize maybe a specific opposition, which is a huge problem in any opposition movement in Russia, because there's no one party, or there's one, barely one candidate, and there's huge dissonance amongst them. But this is why maybe this quote-unquote Pussy Riot breakup is good, because the kind of passive-aggressive letter clearly stated these are the specific things that this group believes in. I take issue at the fact that, like, maybe I'm not butch-looking enough to be a feminist, or they're radical feminists, that's fine, but they outline their specific things, their specific identity, their specific political identity, and their specific political purpose. And kind of, even though I doubt they'll be covered as much as what Masha and Nadia go on to do, but they made it clear, and sometimes you do that even if it makes you a smaller army.
Well, what I like about the letter, and it's probably going to be the most thing that gets passed over, is just, like, the anti-capitalist, you know, conversation. Because that's something that I kind of, like, I see that as kind of going back to the point of, like, what how are they using these funds that we were just talking about. But also just there's a certain, when you bring capitalism involved, it's hard to have a community aspect when you're a capitalist, because most capitalists want to.
It's not just capitalism, it's corporate humanitarianism, it's branded political action. And if I mean, we're in a position right now, especially with all the human rights reporting we're trying to do in Russia, that's related to the anti-gay propaganda bill and the violence there towards LGBT and Sochi and all that, and we're kind of snowballing this evil Russian Empire image, we're forgetting that people there will look at our overall structure and see the inherent evil in that too, which is also clearly obvious, which is the capitalist structure, which
right.
is corporate injustice and all this.
And
that's
one thing that Katya and Masha are doing while they're in the U.S., right, is like they're touring U.S. prisons to go back to. And do you know how long they're in the country for, and what's going to happen when they go back?
I think they're about to leave New York. I'm not sure what their other plans were. I know they traveled to a lot of major cities, but from what I know, there's two organizations they live in, it's just The Voice and then Amnesty International. But that those organizations are geared towards celebrity functions, large donors, and ultimately money talks. Those right. huge sums might be able to do something, maybe not in Russia, but...
Well, that was the other side of it. It's like, is it going to matter? I mean, Madonna was already in a fight with Putin, and so, like, you know...
Madonna got a ticket. Madonna
right,
was not...
but if
it's minor. It also impacted her as a capitalist and her own
exactly.
business
so
maker.
Is anyone, anyone in power in Russia going to really care? I guess that's, what... If anything, it seems like there's more disdain now about, like...
You sound like my grandma. It's just because it's hopeless to a degree, it doesn't mean certain tension shouldn't be sustained and certain people should make a seat.
No, I agree. I meant it more from a very matter-of-fact question. Like, because now you see it, like, there's almost this, like... You know, not the Cold War is back or anything, but there's, Putin's definitely, like, raising this, like, kind of, like, well, we're not going to play second fiddle, we're going to... So it's almost like, the whole theory of, like, oh, I'm going to not like it because that person likes it. Does this make Pussy Riot less impactful in Russia?
No, because over the course of last year, it is not a coincidence that they performed in a church, in that specific church. That specific church, there are weekly broadcasts from it by the Pope of Russia, whatever he's called, and... Just a week ago, or very soon before they did that, he said that Putin was a miracle from God and all Christians should vote for Putin. There's a no separation of church and state there, yeah. which is, of course, if you know the history of USSR, where religion was illegal, they just did a little bit and switch, and now this guy is telling them that they need to vote for Putin or the country goes to hell. Meanwhile, his cabinet and people like Vitaly Milonov, which is... Part of the, he's a priest in training. He's the one that was the biggest sponsor of the anti-gay propaganda bill, which outlaws any mention of it, non-traditional relations to be equal in social value to traditional relations, etc. That law, then the law against blasphemy, and another law against extremist speech on the internet, which could be anything from those assholes that kidnap gays and beat them up to anyone forming a protest, because protesting is illegal. If two people gather within several yards of each other, it's an illegal gathering. Like, he has passed a lot of really big laws, which is actually good material for performance art to disrupt something.
Yeah, what is the general consensus in Russia? I mean, because I say that being is that, like, they weren't, I say this completely separated, but, they weren't, capitalism, I would say, didn't necessarily... Well, I guess they are capitalists, but democracy, quote-unquote, didn't really flourish, it wasn't economically flourishing in the country. So, like, is this something where they like the... Do Russians want sort of an order to get back to that state of, like, power and success?
I don't know what the Russian public wants in general. I know that they have an idea of what they can have, what they can't. And I feel like the idea of... revolution or democratic change is a little bit conceptual to them. Are they happy? Russia's a destabilized country on the brink of collapse, and there's one guy who's keeping in check, and sometimes it doesn't matter that he's doing this by legal means. So
right, that was kind of my point.
What did you guys make of Bill de Blasio meeting with the two members of Pussy Riot? Like, what did that have any significance whatsoever?
I didn't even know that happened.
Yeah. Is that just like a total political sort of...
I'm wondering... Yeah, well, that was the other thing. Is like...
Kiss babies, meet with Pussy Riot.
Yeah, well, but I thought it was like... It was strange because like the meeting was closed to press, but like he wanted everyone to know that they were doing it. And so it was like, well, look, if you're not like... Otherwise, you're sort of wasting their time and you're... Again, it's like probably something that they might look back on and be like, I wish we didn't do that, Especially if de Blasio like shits the bed in a year or two.
I don't think meeting with him was an endorsement and he just wanted to be cool. So.
Right, yeah.
I feel like that was like a Shirlane move too. I feel like she was really into his wife.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I was gonna say his daughter, because she's all into metal.
She's into metal though. Yeah. And she's not even here. She's in California.
Yeah. But she thinks her dad is cool, you guys. Stop ruining it for her.
I still wanna do that metal interview with her.
Someday.
Someday. Well, anyway, Marina, thank you. That was insightful.
And no, I rambled, sorry.
No, it was really good because I definitely I'm an idealist at heart, but as you get older, and I'll say this as what I assume I am being the elder statesman in the room, you tend to start looking at things like, again, idealism versus realism, and what is the best way to get things done. So you look at someone like Pussy Riot, and you're like, clearly this is getting the message to, my mom would have never known who Pussy Riot was, you know, and now all of a sudden it's like, you know, they at least know what the words are. They
I mean, it's the most successful artwork of this century or last 100 years or whatever. Artwork.
Would you argue with Banksy? See, that's another, we should have Bucky on and you could, you
oh,
guys
no.
could argue
no,
that.
No, it's okay. He knows how I feel. No.
You don't want to answer that, though.
No, I mean, this is, I'm serious. This is the most important. Their video that they did was the most important performance and video art piece of the century. And what Vinod did when they graffitied the bridge in St. Petersburg, and when it opened, it flipped off the FSB building, which is like modern-day KGB, and just stood there as a big erect dick for, what, 15 minutes, and they couldn't get it down. That was brilliant. Yeah. That was subversive and great. And that was graffiti, and that was really important.
I'm surprised no one hasn't done that here in America just for fun.
Not enough drawbridges.
Yeah, well, they are. They exist. There's a few of them in New York, you know?
Well, we'll get back to you on that. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm going to commission that.
Take a short break.
Yeah, let's take it. We've got heavy topics today.
We'll BRB.
We will
BRB. Take us away, Joe.
You are listening to Maurice Narcisse by Eula on the heritageradionetwork.org.
In 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
This one's called Oh Lord, also by Eula, on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Oh,
And we're back. Thanks, Joe.
That was the first time we've played music that wasn't a musical guest. What was that, Joe? You're gonna play a.
That was our good friend's Eula from right here in Brooklyn, New York City.
That's a good plug. I like them. They're a good band.
So you know, pedestrian fatalities, people walking on the street, all of that really pleasant things. You know, pleasant topics of discussion. That's become a major issue in New York City this year because of Bill de Blasio in large part. But Tessa Stewart wrote a story last week called "It's Too Easy to Kill Pedestrians in New York City." Was that the subtitle or was that the title?
That was the online title. I think that the print title was "Don't Walk."
Don't Walk. Okay. Yeah. So for our more car-minded listeners and for Derek, explain why it is too easy for pedestrians to be killed in New York City.
Well, I think like the statistic that really that made me want to do this story was that. I mean, you know, like, just reading the newspaper every day, you'll see, like, these one-off stories that are, like, someone was on a sidewalk and a car jumped the curb and hit them, or someone was in a crosswalk, and like, a seven-year-old in Queens and was run down. And so I kept seeing these headlines, and I kept and then there's always this refrain that isn't all of them that's, like, no criminality suspected. It was kind of like, does this happen more in New York than other places? Because I've lived a bunch of other cities, and it feels like these are reported on more. And the statistic that I found was that it's as a share of traffic fatalities, pedestrians are killed at a rate that's five times the national average, which blew my mind. It's 13% nationally as a share of traffic fatalities, and it's 52% in New York. So that was a big deal to me.
And that's because New York is a walking city, or that's because the New York City Police Department perhaps doesn't take these sort of crashes seriously, or like, why is that, you know, did you dig into why that statistic is so high?
I think it's a combination of both those things, that was the conclusion I came to. Yeah, two-thirds of New Yorkers walk or take the subway to work. And that's much higher than other cities, by like, I forget how much, but it's much higher than other cities, and yeah, the other thing is that in some states and other municipalities, there are laws that if you are breaking a law while you kill someone, you can be charged with higher crimes. You can be charged with vehicular manslaughter or criminal negligence or reckless endangerment. But those charges are hardly ever pursued by New York cops. If you kill someone while you're speeding, you'll just be ticketed for speeding. If you kill someone while you're failing to yield, you'll just be ticketed for failure to yield. One of the things that blew my mind is that to charge for vehicular manslaughter, you have to be intoxicated. The driver has to be intoxicated. And that's unique to New York. It's not like that other places.
So that part I wasn't aware of, and that raises a really good point that, you know, you mentioned that, because like you said, that's kind of like the out for a lot of places to kind of charge for people that are negligent and cause this fatality. Because as you know, cars are a much larger
giant device. Hulking yes. pieces yeah. of metal.
But the one, you know, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, and I would like to preface this by saying I do not advocate.
No one likes anyone's. I just want to say no one likes the devil's advocate.
I know. Okay. That's why I keep mentioning that I'm that person, okay. I'm that role today.
As long as that's in there on
yeah.
record.
And you know, we are not in any way, I'm not trying to advocate for more cars or less cars, but one of the things that stuck out is you mentioned the number of fatalities with walkers are way higher in New York, and I would argue that it is because New York is a more walking town. I grew up in Buffalo, and you could drive for miles without seeing someone walking, and that just doesn't happen even on the deadest of nights in New York. But the bigger aspect, and this is something I want to talk to you about. Oh, and then also in your, we actually have less fatalities than the national average
right.
across the board, and so like there's a sort of like, again, that double edged sword. And the reason why I bring this up is because a lot was made about that the child in Queens. Was it Queens or the recent one?
There was one on the Upper West Side.
I think it was the one on the Upper West Side.
Yeah. It was hit by a cab who failed to yield.
And this was something I wanted to ask you specifically about, because doesn't, you know, and I try to read through these things same way you do when you're just like trying to pick apart the minutiae of like someone's generic reporting. Not you, I mean, like if it's in like a small little post, you kind of have to like pick through the little hints that they drop that are, you know, whether it's about race or whether it's about things like that. Isn't failure to yield, doesn't that imply that because pedestrians always have the right of way, that essentially the pedestrian broke the law and that because the driver of the car didn't react in time?
No, actually, so failure, I think that failure, there are all kinds of different variations of failure to yield. There's like failure to yield to a pedestrian in the roadway, which is not in the crosswalk.
Okay.
And then there's failure to yield, like when someone's in a crosswalk. There's actually like 12, and this was really confusing to me when I was doing this story. But one of the things that I found out was that more pedestrians are killed while they're in the crosswalk with the light than are killed outside of the crosswalk. So, it's not by that much, but I think it's like 44% are killed when they're in the crosswalk with the light, and like 38% when they're in the crosswalk without the light, and then 2% that like are on the sidewalk,
right.
A car jumps up on the sidewalk and kills them.
Is that percentage? Does it kind of equate with? I mean, clearly it doesn't if you're saying that most of the people get off without any criminal charges. But does that at all equate to the numbers? Like, do you see an increase in the amount of people that are killed? Obviously, I would hope that people get killed on the sidewalk. There's much more higher criminality than, say, you know.
No, yeah. I mean, actually, I think that you might know, but I feel like I, as like in my reporting, I feel like there's one time that I saw that a driver drove up on a sidewalk and he was charged with reckless driving. But that's for like at least 10 cases this year. And that guy was really reckless. It was in Fort Greene, and he went the wrong way down the street, then it did a U-turn and went the other way, and then went up on the sidewalk and back down and back up, and finally like killed this child.
Only New York prosecutors are very hesitant to bring those charges. And when the police investigate anything, they do something that's really unusual. Any other crime, if I came up to you and like stole your cell phone or hit you over the head and an officer saw it, or an officer had witnesses to testify to that effect, they would arrest me immediately and then let the DA's office sort of suss everything out after. With vehicular homicides or you know, vehicular fatalities, the police department actually calls the DA's office before they arrest anyone, before they charge anyone, and say, is this case winnable, yes or no? And 9 times out of 10, the DA's office is going to say no. So when the cabbie in Midtown this past August hit a cyclist and then jumped the curb and then hit this tourist from England and caused her leg to be amputated, and he had a bad driving record, he was given a citation because he was driving the wrong cab that day from the TLC, and he was suspended for a few weeks. No charges, no... You know, but no criminality there.
And that's
the police and the DA ruled that.
And this cab driver admitted
that
he was trying to hit the bicyclist.
Right.
So then that becomes my question regarding, you know, what I jokingly refer to as yellow journalism when I say like you guys are always taking the sides of like the not car people. But shouldn't then the story be like, why can't these people be charged?
Because and it is. And part of it is that, you know, there is case law to suggest that it is the standard for what attorneys will call moral blameworthiness is very high in New York State, and that is true. And the Wall Street Journal did a story on that a few days ago. However, it's about having the political will and just the will of these law enforcement agencies to do it.
Well, that's what I mean. I think that's where the pressure should be. And I'm not trying to single you guys out. Chris have this conversation a lot. And I guess... Well, I'll let you speak. Finish what you were going to say.
I was just going to say, I think that political will is important, but I don't think that... I think that you can have political will, and it can't go far enough. I think that a good example of that is D.A. Vance, who's the Manhattan D.A. He was elected by, like, the streets advocate people.
Yeah.
And he was going to, like, take this really seriously. And he has not been able to take this seriously. But there was one case that was this guy, Ian Clement, who was a mail carrier, and he was in a car, or he was in a like mail truck, and he ran over the cyclist. There's a video of him doing it. He stayed at the scene for like 2 minutes and then drove away, and then came back 2 hours later and was like, I think I'm the guy that you're looking for. So he left the scene. the DA made a very unusual move to prosecute this case in the first place, but he thought, like, I have this evidence, I have this videotape of him running her over and staying at the scene and then coming back later. And even with that much evidence, he couldn't get a jury to convict for leaving the scene, to convict. So I think that the standard is very high, and I think that even when there's political will there, like, that he's an elected official. So if he can't win cases, like, he runs on his record of, like, how many cases he's won. So if he can't win those cases, he's not going to prosecute them.
Right. I mean, although I will say Cy Vance has had a pretty shitty record up, you know.
Yeah, I think he's had
to date across the board. But I mean, you're talking about evidence. You want as much good evidence as you can possibly have, right? Because the standard's so high. Well, then on that side of the coin, you have an NYPD that is unwilling to properly and thoroughly investigate these things when they happen, when, you know, at the time when they actually happen.
Right.
In other words, someone will get killed. They won't interview. They won't try and pick up surveillance tapes for days, weeks afterwards. They'll lose evidence. Well, they'll refuse to turn it over to the victim's families.
And I think that's the part that, as someone who is trying to read through everything, is that's where I find that there's the fault, and like, how do we get through that? And also in the case of the cabbie in Midtown in August, didn't she decide not to press charges? Wasn't that part of the story?
No, it's not about her pressing charges. She's going to file a civil suit. Her attorney said that that will happen. It's just that the DA's office literally didn't, I mean, who, like, maybe the police department did conduct a really thorough investigation and they thought that they wouldn't win that case. I don't know if I believe that.
That case, which was really high profile, they did say, they released a statement, and I don't know if it's
right.
You know, who knows if
were like, we spent many weeks on this evidence or whatever. I mean, obviously, all, you know, a lot of attorneys who are on like the Streets PAC side or who are activists disagree with it vehemently. But right, I mean, but the case that happened at Fort Greene, that was probably the most egregious, you know,
right,
incident of it, and then they brought charges because it was so egregious.
And as the
I think it was DUI too, wasn't it? Wasn't that person drunk?
I don't remember.
That always flips it over to the other scale. Was once you can prove
that
someone
wasn't actually. I mean, I don't know, but I remember usually when it's DUI, it's like so easy to charge. But I'm not sure about that one. It might have been. I don't know.
So here's what Derek hates. Derek hates bike lanes.
No. Let me ask you this. Do you drive?
I do drive. I was living in LA before I moved to New York.
So the reason why I look at things from a very broad point of view, because I would say I am an equal amount driver, walker, and subway person. Obviously, subway and bicyclist.
With a little bit of bike thrown in.
No, I bike a lot in the summer, but I'm not one of those people that bikes in the winter. But and car, I would say I drive like once or twice a month, but enough to kind of get the vibe from New York. And I would say if I was to do an overall thing, and I love the fact that there's more bike lanes. I'm fine with them trying to reduce the need
for
that.
I don't know about
Let me explain where I'm going with this. But like, okay, so cars, if they're about to be, you know, most, you know, they're road rage, they get angry, and that's where I probably a lot of these things stem from.
Not you, though. I've never seen you angry about it.
No, I'm not.
You're total zen. You have a little green tea brewer in your dash.
But when it comes to feeling like they have a sense of entitlement, I would say walkers and bicyclists kind of go beyond that more so than cars, because cars, you can't drive down the wrong way. Well, people do it, but those are the, you know, exceptions to the case. You know, you can't go through a red light, you know, whereas like walkers are always like jaywalking type of thing. And then you get those ones who are basically, you know, like my friend Chris here, who are so anti-car that they're going to do things like walk really slowly across the crosswalk, or ride side by side.
I don't know about that.
Walk side by side, or ride side by side in a bike lane, or like things that you know. Like I said, and again, I realize the difference between a giant hulking piece of metal, and there's a whole other context that you should talk about when you're talking about this, because you know there's a reason why we're so car dependent, and that has a lot to do with, like, you know, America throughout the 40s and 50s and 60s.
And Robert fucking Moses, exactly. And other things.
You know, but that said, I do feel like the attack that you guys, you know, I don't want to label it attack, because people are dying, and there's reasons why we should be talking about this. But, like, I don't see it as, like, a car versus bike versus pedestrian thing. And I would say that the numbers that you brought up, specifically the number of pedestrians that are killed compared to other cities, would point to that. The issue is, why when a child is killed, or, and the moral subject, I can't remember the moral what is the word
for blameworthiness?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal, because if you kill someone, you're gonna that's gonna stay with you unless you're a pretty gutless person. So, like, I do start to see it from that side of, you know, like, I don't personally know anyone that has struck and killed someone, but I have to assume that it weighs on people pretty heavily. I'm more frustrated by the egregious poor driving that can get away without, you know what I mean? Like, versus someone that, like, you know, kind of like, you know, was this an accident? Is it just because, like, a car is heavier than a person type of thing? Mm-hmm.
Do you see it as, like, a cars versus pedestrians thing?
No, I don't. I mean, like, I don't think so. It's interesting, kind of like the responses that you get when you put, like, this. I put this piece out there, and the responses I got. I feel like I got a lot of people saying that I was lumping. No, I got one person saying I was lumping cyclists and pedestrians together, and then a lot of, like, I got, like, a truck driver and a bus driver who were like, the pedestrians, like, you have no idea, this is so wrong. Like,
well that's probably, you know, some bus driver would probably be a good person to talk to, because that's all they have to do is weave in and out. Marina, I know you have a very personal story to this,
well,
though, don't you?
That's why I wanted to ask if there's a reason, is there motivation for NYPD to be so willfully negligent in investigating this?
Well, I think that one of the things that Bratton, who's the new police commissioner, said before he was appointed was that, like, cops just don't think that these are sexy crimes, basically. That they're like, you don't become a cop to, like, investigate. he essentially said that. And I think that that's basically what they say. The other thing that they say is something that, like, with the Sean Green case in Midtown, who is the British tourist who got her leg severed by the cab. In most cases, they like to just be able to, like, this is a civil case now. This person hit you. Take
but doesn't
it up
that
with
affect
them.
Us well, as taxpayers then?
It
it's like, shouldn't that be a matter for? Are they going to sue the taxi cab, or are they going to sue the city?
Sean Green's lawyer said that there's a number of people, he enumerated a number of people that he could sue. He was like, I could sue Rockefeller Center because they didn't have, planners up to...
Bollards.
Yeah, I could sue the city because, the street was bad there. I'm going to sue the Taxi and Limousine Commission.
Because they let this guy drive after having such a bad...
New headline, never mind the bollards. You guys can use that. Mm-hmm. Feel free to use that.
That's nice. But I think it's actually a really big problem that there are so few... I think the biggest problem is that they dedicate so few officers to investigating hit and runs or traffic fatalities.
Well, I got hit by a car 2 years ago. I was on Graham. I was crossing on a green light at 10 p.m. A car was speeding through a green light at about 45 miles per hour. Hit me. Rode with me. Was trying to do a hit and run, so I was on top of the hood for half a block. Then she stopped because I wasn't coming off, and I flew off. And the police officer at the scene told me I was annoying because I couldn't tell him who to call. I had my face broken. I was semi-conscious. And then he recorded on the police report that I ran across the street where I ended up, not where I was originally hit, because she carried me half a block down. Obviously, I wasn't killed, but it took me 8 months of calling the police station every single day, because I wasn't even in New York at the time. I was calling every day. I was calling to get in touch with this guy and say, can you please update the police report? I actually was in the green light, not even, like, across the street and down the block, and he just was...
So what was the end result of your situation, if you don't mind me asking?
I got... $13,000 for medical expenses, which I'm used up already.
No, that's
I still have permanent back injuries.
Right. And was that through the driver?
That was through her insurance company, yeah. But and a lawyer, but
maybe
he did not do a DUI. He did not test her. It's nothing. He didn't look at the scene or tracks or anything. He just made fun of me while I was standing. I was just wondering if they're.
You're talking about something that happens literally, you know, more than a dozen times a day, really. You talk about crashes or collisions in New York City, and when you only have 20 detectives to investigate the whole city of 8 million people, and then, like, a few supervisors, a few people who are technically proficient with the equipment, you know, they say they have 5 people or whatever who can operate some of this stuff. So it's like, you know, they just see it as like, oh, well, she's not dead, so we don't need to do anything.
I wonder if that's also part of it, too, in the sense that, like, they probably look at it like an insurance thing. Like, oh, it'll be covered by insurance, right, so that there's less of a need to prosecute on a criminal level.
Right, but I think it's also a problem when someone doesn't die and they don't investigate it. Then if that person tries to pursue like a civil case against the driver, they don't have the evidence because the police didn't collect the evidence. I saw a
I was going to say that would almost be like Marina's situation.
Yeah. I saw this guy cyclist got run over in Williamsburg, outside the Lorimer stop. And the car ran off. We got the license plate number, called an ambulance. The police came and interviewed all of these people and then called a week later and were like, you're the only contact number we have. Did you see the person? Because we matched the license plate to a car of that description that lives in that neighborhood. But if you don't have a description of the person who was driving, we're not going to do anything about it. And this guy was crushed by, broke his legs, across his chest,
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you would, if you're watching Law and Order, they would get to the bottom of that. Right. That's what's so angry. That's what's annoying about it. I do think a lot of it's probably, what Chris was saying is a shortage of manpower. This also reminds me of situations where children that go missing on a regular level or regular basis or homeless children that never gets reported, but if a child of someone of notoriety or of wealth or something like that, it gets reported when that stuff kind of happens on a daily basis. And, it's kind of how do you make that of a discussion topic on a more regular level?
That's a brilliant idea. They should do Law and Order IRL. And it's a week long, just live shuffling papers and just waiting.
That would be.
I like it.
Well, I think we all learned something tonight.
I think we did. I'm still angry. Not at you. Not at the. I'm not.
I was gonna. I'm sorry. Go on.
No. She finished. No.
I was just gonna say. I feel like that's what bringing even when it is a topic of conversation, even when there is high profile like I would say the cab in Midtown case.
Right.
It's amazing that even when it is such a big case and it is a topic of conversation, that still nothing. Still, there were no charges.
Right. And what angers me is that that angers me too.
Just so you both know.
The car lobby likes to paint owning an automobile as some lower class, blue collar, regular Joe sort of thing, when far more New Yorkers take public transit, far more of them walk, far more of them bike, or maybe not bike. Biking is seen as something that poor people do, right? It's like a de classe sort of thing. Look at that poor person on his bike. That's the stuff that makes me angry and think it's look, this is just a few people who are in positions of power who just point their megaphones towards this ridiculous issue of, they're closing in on us in our roads.
Well,
and that's the vibe that you get a lot, when you pick up any of the city's major newspapers, even the Times,
New Yorker
will run articles of teary eyed about the car era. And it's look, this isn't the reality that we live in. And you have this responsibility. You have, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And that's the stuff that really gets my goat.
It is really crazy. The New York Times did this story that was the headline was 3 killed in car accidents.
Right.
And then it turned out that it was all 3 were pedestrians who were hit. And two were on a sidewalk. And it's why don't you just say 3 pedestrians killed
by
cars?
It's interesting because the Times refuses to retire the word accident, right?
Right.
It should be collision. And the police department changed their nomenclature from accident to collision. The Times won't do it. The Times will say accident, even when someone is clearly to blame, even when it's so subtle things like that.
Do you think it's a classist? Do you think it's a classist or an elitist?
I think it is. And it's a sort of this relic of this bygone era of I brought up Robert Moses. Robert Moses built the parkways out in Long Island so that the rich people could drive their cars on a Sunday, because that's what people did, Sunday drivers. They would get out in their cars and drive. So little of the population could do that then, and so little of the population does that now. It just doesn't make any sense to take this position of...
I agree. I agree with what you're saying.
This is the common man.
This is why I don't...
These elite...
Agree with you, especially when you see people that are bringing up there's less parking or whatever stupid reason they can give for not having bike lanes versus. But the flip side of that, and I use this for a lot of my discussions for, whether it's taxation or anything like that, is that my general overarching philosophy is that most people are good, and that 10% of the population, give or take, however much you want to say, is the corrupt portion of society. And that portion is going to exist in car drivers, in walkers, in bicyclists. So I don't like the notion of tagging, you know, cars as evil either, on the flip of what you guys are suggesting. But now if you wanted to have the conversation about why aren't these things followed up with, why is it so easy for people to get away with, that's the conversation.
Right,
if a pedestrian bumps into a car, the car is going to be okay. It's not armed with a potentially deadly weapon. So they're not really equal.
And so I will say evils might be the wrong word, but deadly certainly is the correct word. And
or
I would
dangerous.
Argue that deadly and dangerous is, you know, equally as abhorrent as evil, if
I
not
agree.
More so.
And this goes almost, I agree. But what I'm saying is you got to go beyond like the personal level. It's kind of like the smoking thing that we talk about. It's like, I don't necessarily believe in taxing the consumer who's part of this thing that was orchestrated long before we were all here. So that's my whole point, is like, if we're a car-driven society, that's what you have to attack, not attack the people who are a part of that society that may use it to like get to work or go see their friends, because that's how the way they were.
Or just drive around, you know, and just hang out.
I mean, you look at places that are like, you know, this is a conversation that's come up with the whole Atlanta thing, where like people waited 20 hours to go 2 miles because of 2 inches of snow. And it's like, you know, that's when people should be like, do we really need to have this infrastructure? But that's not the conversation. We're talking about isolated incidents. And that's why I feel it's a little bit unfair. Because I try.
They're simplifying. But it's also readers who read these stories and simplify the issue, saying how this is cars versus, like, if you offer the pieces, tell you that's not it. But, yeah, we're aware that is that way.
Right. Me and Chris just also like to butt heads on this.
Well, we didn't get to congestion pricing, but that's what really needs to be talked
about.
But
see,
so that there's less cars on the road to begin with.
You want
to
talk about that.
So that there's less collisions,
right.
So there's less...
But no, to go back to your point, congestion pricing is inherently anti-blue collar, because the places that they want to raise prices are the places that people need to get to for work reasons. You know, like when Bloomberg raised that, notice that it wasn't congestion pricing in the part of Manhattan where he lived. Basically, Upper Manhattan.
Yeah,
it was every place that anyone who needs to get to work has to go.
The plans are
same thing
perfect.
With the bridge crossings over the East River. Most of those are like truck drivers or people like that.
What do you think, Tessa?
You know what? I don't know very much about congestion pricing at all. Sorry.
Okay.
Anyway,
all right. Fine.
We didn't need to just devolve into like Derek and Chris's weekly dialogue.
I think that if you're looking for a barometer of how car oriented our society is, you can like listen to the radio and they'll tell you every morning like if alternate side parking is in effect,
right.
And it's like that only affects like 20% of New Yorkers, and it's
right. No, I agree. Like that was one of the big. I read this column. It was by it was in AM New York, which I don't like to necessarily say that all that often, but it was written by a law professor, a history professor from NYU, who was talking about basically like. When everyone complains about the snow, depending on the era that they've complained about, it's about what they personally have to deal with. And right now, people are complaining about the snow. All the complaints seem to stem from because their cars can't get around. Whereas if you're taking the subway or walking, those people aren't really complaining. So, you know, I think to that extent, I think that's a valid point.
Well, Tessa, Marina, thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
Thanks.
If it didn't sound like it, I was very, very glad that you were both here. Sorry. These are just topics I like talking about. And when that happens... You know, I talk about them.
All right, Derek.
Yeah.
I'll see you next week.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.